This is a Discovery Channel Radio podcast. Learn more about our podcast, including Discovery Channel News Podcast, at discoverychannelradio.com. You can also get Discovery Channel Radio 24 hours a day on Sirius Satellite Radio. Learn more at Sirius.com.
It's the most exciting city in the world, but you might not have known that New York is where your favorite comic book superheroes live. Spider-Man, Daredevil, Captain America, The Avengers, The Fantastic Four. From Hell's Kitchen to Greenwich Village, from Midtown to the Statue of Liberty, New York is a dazzling backdrop for epic battles between good and evil. Born and bred in the Big Apple in the 1930s, the comic book industry has soaked up the character of the city and created a universe that reflects its hometown. Fascinating, exhilarating, and open all night.
New York is a great environment for superheroes because it's got all the things that superheroes need.
You walk down the streets, there's towers that touch clouds. You know, this is the stuff of fantasy.
It has tall buildings to leap over. Somehow the Hulk tearing up the Southwest desert never looked as good as when he came to New York and was fighting on the skyscrapers.
For Stan Lee, the co-creator of Spider-Man with artist Steve Ditko, real life is the blueprint for his art. In the early 1960s, Stan did something that changed comics forever. He and his team based Spider-Man and their other creations on the fabric of New York City.
So many other characters lived in cities like Gotham City and Metropolis, but I suspect the readers knew those cities were just made up. And I wanted to make the reader suspend disbelief.
Often when I walked down the streets, as I would be plotting a story, I would look up and try to imagine what it would really be like if you were just walking down a street and you looked up and here was Spider-Man swinging from one building to another.
I experienced New York on television in movies, but primarily, predominantly, growing up, I experienced it in the pages of Marvel Comics.
Matt Murdock lives in Hell's Kitchen. Doctor Strange is downtown. They have Fantastic Four right in the heart of Manhattan. So all these superheroes have their little spots in Manhattan, and it's exciting. It's accurate.
I'm a guy who takes the easy way out. I had lived in New York most of my life. I loved New York, but mainly I knew New York. If I had wanted the stories to take place in Chillicothe, Ohio, I would have been at a loss.
Over 4,700 characters live in the world of Marvel Comics, but our first spin around New York City has to start with its most famous guardian, Spider-Man.
The character of Spider-Man is ever-present in the city. He's a New Yorker in every sense of the word. He's a wise guy.
In an effort to make these characters, fantastic as they were, seem as realistic as possible, I felt that they should have real problems.
Our heroes are heroes with feet of clay. You know, they all have sort of an Achilles heel, something that makes them more human.
And especially in the world of Marvel, I think it was a comfort to a kid to know, even if you had all these powers, you might still have problems, so, you know, maybe it's not so terrible being me.
If you could accept the fact that somebody was bitten by a radioactive spider and now could climb walls and shoot webs and have the proportionate strength of a spider, I'm very proud of that, the proportionate strength of a spider. If you could accept that, and if I could make everything else absolutely realistic, wouldn't that be more fun? I had Peter Parker, Spider-Man. I had him live in Forest Hills, which was a real place. There was a Forest Hills. And he lived in a little house there with his aunt.
Spider-Man's universe is 80% reality, 20% fantasy. The melodrama. Peter Parker's life is so exciting because you can't wait till he gets that costume on. But too much of the costume, it wouldn't be good. But that large amount of reality makes the fantasy that much more fun.
But fun is a relative term in Peter Parker's romantic life. His undying love for the girl next door, the beautiful and fiery Mary Jane, is an ever-present storyline. But the first girl to steal his heart and a thorn in Mary Jane's side was a gorgeous blonde named Gwen Stacy. In Spider-Man's world, Gwen is forever linked with one of the greatest architectural achievements of the 19th century, the Brooklyn Bridge. The first steel cable suspension bridge in the world claimed nearly 30 lives during its 13 years of construction. It is majestic, it is an icon, and it set the stage for the darkest hour of Peter Parker's life.
It's this embodiment of New York City, and it becomes the embodiment of the worst possible thing that has ever happened to Spider-Man.
When Spider-Man was unable to save his girlfriend from the evil Green Goblin, it was a turning point in the comic industry and in the way the fans would forever relate to their heroes. The tragic death of Gwen Stacy marked the first time a superhero's love interest was killed in the pages of a comic. Comic creators have one distinct advantage over the characters they invent. Their mistakes aren't a matter of life and death.
In the famous death of Gwen Stacy, I put them atop the Brooklyn Bridge because it's the most decorative of the bridges. It's a very distinctive-looking bridge. And when it came out, I noticed that Stan had called it the George Washington Bridge.
Hell, you've seen one bridge, you've seen them all. A bridge is a bridge.
So to this day, all the reprints of the Gwen Stacy saga have her being thrown over the George Washington Bridge, but it was the Brooklyn Bridge.
From uptown to midtown to downtown, from the east side to the west side, superheroes are everywhere.
We were the first ones to have all our superheroes in essentially the same place in New York City. I thought of them as our little repertory group, and they would guest star in each other's stories. The fans started referring to it as the Marvel Universe.
Here they were, and they could run into each other. Spider-Man would be swinging along and suddenly run into Daredevil. Every hero knew everybody else. They didn't necessarily like each other, but they knew each other.
For just about anybody, Manhattan can be a big and intimidating place. If you hope to catch a superhero in action, you better know where to look. Probably the best place to start your tour is smack dab in the middle of Manhattan, Central Park. This man-made haven has been the perfect escape for New Yorkers for the last 130 years.
Anytime you needed a park for any story, Central Park had everything. It had riding paths, it had a zoo, it had muggers.
While you'll enjoy visiting Central Park, criminals should think twice before disturbing this serene setting. These days, a bounty is on their heads. Frank Castle was a man of the law. A family man, a man whose life was shattered after his wife and children were gunned down while picnicking in the park. In that moment, a vigilante was born, Frank's unforgiving alter ego, the Punisher.
It really kind of sent Frank over the edge. And he's sort of like the Terminator in a lot of ways, where he will not stop until crime is completely gone. And so, obviously, crime may never be completely gone, so the Punisher will keep on going and going.
If you walk out of the park on the Upper East Side, a popular superhero landmark comes into view. Set back from Fifth Avenue by an elevated garden, you'll find the world-renowned Frick Collection. The New York home for Renoir and Vermeer also serves as the headquarters for Earth's mightiest heroes, the Avengers.
I just loved the name, the Avengers. Well, they had to have a headquarters. Every group needs a headquarters. There was a mansion called the Frick Museum that I used to walk past. I sort of modeled it after that. A beautiful, big, so impressive building right on Fifth Avenue.
It was the wealthy playboy of the Marvel Universe, Tony Stark, a.k.a. Iron Man, who donated his personal mansion for the nonprofit crime fighters' exclusive use.
When they had to get together, instead of just getting a phone call and saying, hey, we need you over at the mansion, I decided that whoever was the leader would say something like, Avengers assemble! And that became their rallying cry. You can see why I'm called one of the courtiest men in comics, or maybe anywhere.
But if you happen to miss the Avengers at their Fifth Avenue headquarters, then there's a good chance you'll catch one of them addressing the United Nations. Located right along the East River, the United Nations is a monument to the struggle for international peace and security. The Avengers team leader, Captain America, is a frequent speaker. Just a few blocks away on 42nd Street in Lexington, you can find Marvel's first family of superheroes, the Fantastic Four, at the Baxter Building. It's the home and headquarters of Mr. Fantastic, Dr. Reed Richards, his wife Susan, the Invisible Woman, her little brother Johnny, the Human Torch, and Ben Grimm, best known as the ever-loving blue-eyed Thing.
The Baxter Building is just a normal business building, except that the top four floors have been completely remodeled. Reed Richards put in a launching platform for this pogo plane that would take off straight up into the air. That's got to create vibrations. The thing is likely to tear up the elevator, or some supervillain will attack them because they want revenge on the Fantastic Four. I don't think anybody would really want to live next to the Baxter Building.
Tough times are nothing new to the Thing. He originally hailed from downtown, where he grew up on the mean streets of the East Village.
I thought it would be fun, instead of these heroes having nothing but fans, if there was a group who didn't like them, who especially didn't like the Thing and was always tormenting them. There was a street in New York called Delancey Street, and we decided to call the gang the Yancey Street Gang, which sounded like Delancey Street, and they were nasty and they were always taunting the Thing, and it just, to me, had the right sound, the Yancey Street Gang.
But you just can't have one superhero patrolling this section of Manhattan. It's too trendy for that.
We always went down to the Village, and there was colorful people walking around all the time. Greenwich Village was wonderful.
With a history steeped in folk music and beat poetry, Greenwich Village is the perfect bohemian neighborhood for a superhero who bears the title of Earth's Sorcerer Supreme.
Dr. Strange is actually a doctor. He started off as a very spoiled, rich surgeon. Lost the use of his hands, and he went off to Tibet and became a mystic. And now he spends his time protecting humanity from all these weird creatures and beasties and evil magicians who are out there trying to take over the world. But, of course, it's all headquartered in Dr. Strange's mansion in Greenwich Village. Stan always had grandiose terms for these things, so that was Dr. Strange's sanctum sanctorum.
New York City is where the comic book industry was born. It's where the publishers, artists, and writers lived and worked. Lucky for them, inspiration was everywhere they looked.
As I worked in the business, suddenly I had to start drawing New York City. And it was important that I was accurate because it was New York City and this is Spider-Man. You have got to have the city in the background. You can't have many blank panels behind him. When he's changing angles, there's a building behind him. When he lands on the street, there's got to be people in the street. There's always people in the street in this city.
John Romita Jr. is one of the most influential artists working today. But drawing superheroes isn't an easy gig. Thousands of artists are constantly trying to break into the industry. Just outside New York City, at the Joe Kubert School of Cartoon and Graphic Art, an intensive three-year curriculum gives comic industry hopefuls the chance to study with a master artist.
The best advice that I could give my students is the same advice that many others had given me when I started out, and that is just to keep at it.
Everyone here is pretty big into comic books.
I just like to draw. It's nice being in a place where I can do just that.
I want to get better. I want to get to the point where I think I'm good. I'm still working on that.
Yeah, I'd like to publish my own book. It's kind of a dream right now. I don't know, 10 years maybe somebody cares, other than my dad.
When Joe Kubert was just starting out in the 1930s, New York was the gateway to America. Millions of immigrants had passed through Ellis Island, seeking a better life in the New World. Like America itself, the brand new comic book industry had an open door.
It was the bottom, and that's where you could get work, wanting to make a living as an artist. You know, the place where they would take you, where they would have you, regardless of who you were or where you came from, was comics.
The roots of Marvel Comics actually began in 1939. One of the big boys on the block at that time was Joe Simon, the co-creator of Captain America.
I was about 24. All of us were so young, and as I look back, these guys were so talented. We were doing whole comic books and creating great superheroes at that age.
Those were the golden years. Michael Chabon captured the era in his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay.
That period and that place, New York City, in that golden age of comic books, had always been of great interest to me. Almost every popular art form has been stigmatized at the beginning of its career.
My name was Stanley Martin Lieber, which I think is a beautiful name. And I was sure one day I would write the great American novel by Stanley M. Lieber. And I didn't want to use my name. So I just cut my first name in half and I used the pen name Stan Lee. I'm really sorry I did it because it's a dumb name.
Who knew this maligned trade would turn into an art form and transform a silly pen name into an American icon? As a teenager, Stan Lee found his real-life superheroes at 330 West 42nd Street in the Art Deco glory of the McGraw-Hill Building.
When I started with Marvel, I was 16 and a half or 17 years old, and I worked there. Oh, man, it was great. And they weren't called Marvel then. It was called Timely Comics. There was Joe Simon and Jack Kirby. And Jack was sitting at a drawing board all the time, puffing away at his cigar. Joe was occasionally at a drawing board and often just walking around and doing whatever the editor would do. And he was puffing a cigar. And if secondhand smoke would kill you, I should be dead by now because these guys smoke these big cigars. They were the two most glamorous men in the world to me.
Simon and Kirby made history in December 1940 when their creation, Captain America, splashed across newsstands everywhere. This patriotic hero made a grand entrance into the Timely comic world, punching the lights out of one of the cruelest villains of all time.
What would be a better villain than Adolf Hitler? Get a live guy who is hated all over the world, and then get a superhero to fight against him. And thinking, I would say, the superhero has to be a real red, white, and blue patriotic hero. That's the beginning of Captain America.
Fighting America's enemies on paper wasn't always popular at home, especially before America entered the war in Europe.
Nazis had a big following in New York City. They had a convention at Madison Square Garden, and one of the topics that was brought up was Captain America making fun of their Führer.
After the Hitler cover debuted, Captain America's creators found themselves locked out of the Timely offices by crowds of pro-Nazi demonstrators. Days later, there would be a bomb scare.
It became a little battlefield of its own. We'd come up to work every day, and we'd make our way through the crowds, and we were just too stupid to know that we were in danger.
With Captain America leading the charge in comic book popularity, the fortunes of Timely Comics rose with him. They moved their office space to the premier location of 34th and 5th Avenue, the Empire State Building.
That is the building. It is the building of New York City. The tallest, the most imposing, the most beautiful, I think.
At a miraculous 102 stories, it was touted as the eighth wonder of the world.
If you were a kid in 1937 and you looked at the Empire State Building, you saw the future. I mean, that's what the future was supposed to look like.
Perhaps New York's most enduring icon, the building has played an enormously influential role in the pages of comics.
When you can show real buildings, when you can show the Empire State Building, it doesn't make New York City fictional. It makes your characters seem that much more factual.
The Marvel Universe may be based in reality, but reality can be a comic creator's mortal enemy.
I had Spider-Man swinging up to the Empire State Building, and I absentmindedly had the webbing come from the top of the panel. And we got hundreds of letters saying, where was he swinging from? If he was at the Empire State Building, what's above the Empire State Building? Stan Lee wrote back in the letters page, a helicopter was out of sight up there.
Under the watchful eye of the readers, the popularity of comics grew, as did the bullpens, where the writers and artists created the most beloved superheroes in history. The heroic Captain America, a red-hot crime fighter called the Human Torch, and the tormented Prince Namor, the Submariner.
The Submariner was almost a villain from the start. He was half human himself, but he hated humanity because they had accidentally destroyed his undersea cities with their explosions trying to get out of the Antarctic ice.
He was great because he wasn't a goody-goody guy. He was angry and he was strong. He was kind of an undersea Clint Eastwood.
The testy Submariner had a love-hate relationship with the city. One never knew what kind of mood he'd be in when he emerged from the placid waters of the New York Harbor.
Of course, he doesn't go to London and he doesn't go to Buenos Aires. You know, he comes all the way from the Antarctic to New York.
As the 1940s disappeared, so did the public's interest in comics, and the famous bullpens dwindled to almost nothing. The golden age of comics was over. Or was it? A decade later, the 1960s ushered in the silver age of comics, and Marvel came roaring back to life with what would become the world's most successful superhero franchise. New editor-in-chief Stan Lee and his cohorts devised fascinating, complicated new heroes like the Fantastic Four, the Incredible Hulk, and of course, Spider-Man.
It was a wonderful way to work. I just loved those days. We had, I think, the most talented artists that had ever been in comics or anywhere else.
Birthplace of the comic industry, landscape of the Marvel Universe. New York City is also home to many of the comic book industry's top creators. For John Romita Jr. and his father, John Sr., drawing comics is a family tradition. They've been putting Spider-Man and other heroes on the page for nearly 40 years.
When John was 9 years old, I started Daredevil. And that's the first time he ever paid attention to what I was drawing. His eyes popped out of his head. And he came over and said, "What's that? What's going on there?" And when I told him this was a blind superhero surrounded by pirates, he said, "Wow." And that was it. From that minute on, he was going to be a comic artist no matter what I told him. He started drawing immediately. That if you want the guy who can do epic action and human emotion, you go to my son. John Jr. does it.
You wouldn't have to be a little biased, would you? No,
well, I'm telling you, as an art director, I cannot get over my son following in my footsteps because he's done many more Spider-Man issues than I have. And I'm pleased this punch. I think it's great.
Pleased this punch. You set the bar high for yourself when you draw in a business that your father is in. And I think it made me a better artist and a better man, that's for sure.
When the city that he's drawn through the decades met its darkest day, John Romita Jr.'s art was destined to imitate life.
I was up working, and the news flash came on. I was in shock, and my wife was in shock. And we sat down and cried on the floor.
But when they started to come down, I found myself like a child saying, "No, no, don't let that tower go down. Don't let it go down. Oh, please don't let it go down."
The comic book industry, including Marvel, wanted to help in any way they could. Comic creators of every generation focused their talents on honoring the real heroes of September 11th in the books Heroes and A Moment of Silence.
I remember how quickly the comic book community responded.
We wanted to do something because we just felt that something needed to be done and we needed to express ourselves.
Every artist and writer did the best he could to express his and her feelings and sympathy and unity, and it was just such a great outpouring of emotion.
The books raised over $1 million for the Twin Towers Fund, but having a comic universe based on New York City meant addressing September 11th in the storylines of their characters.
The city of New York is a major character in Spider-Man. And suddenly, the city itself is the main point of everything in the world.
The September 11th issue of Amazing Spider-Man is unlike any other in the series.
It's called the Black Issue because nothing on the cover would make sense other than the black image. It turned out to be a black issue, literally and figuratively.
In the Black Issue, Spider-Man and his superhero friends arrive at the Twin Towers moments too late.
Metaphorically, Spider-Man represented the frustration in all of us and how frustrated we all felt that we couldn't do anything about it, nothing could be done. We stood and watched people die. Usually I remember pages and panels that I've worked on and associate them with moments. My son will come in, there'll be something going on outside the house and I'll be working on a specific page and I'll coordinate the two of them. None of the panels in that book spur a memory. Nothing does. To this day, I can't open it up. I can't open the book up and look at it.
Marvel also honored the real-life firefighters of 9/11 with the book The Call of Duty, which takes you inside the world of a Brooklyn firehouse where the firefighters are a family and heroism is just part of the job.
My son is an editor for Marvel Comics, And after the 9/11, they wanted to do a comic book about the real-life heroes of 9/11. And that's how the comic was born.
I think it's pretty neat being in a comic book. I mean, I don't think any guy in a firehouse will tell you he feels like a superhero. Average people become firefighters.
So what are you saying over there?
In the comic, there's a quote, "You never have to look behind you because you know there'll be somebody there." And that's pretty much the way the job is. You know, you're crawling down a hallway, you never have to look back because you know there's going to be another fireman there if you get in trouble to help you out.
This profession is a call to duty. You know, you do what you can to help people out.
I think having the book, it'll definitely help me remember the day and the people, all the men we lost.
Heroism, in real life, dwarfs even what Spider-Man can do. And the true heroes are those guys in the uniforms.
As New York City heals itself, Romita Jr. is incorporating the progress at Ground Zero into the panels of Amazing Spider-Man.
It's not being cleaned up anymore. It's being built up. I intend on being on Spider-Man for as long as it takes to finish that site.
You've been listening to a Travel Channel feature presentation.